Thanks, Claire, very much. And let me add my welcome to you, Andrew, both to those who are here in the Naval College and to those who are joining us online. Welcome. I think it's possible that some people don't have a service yet, and it would help you. So if you're in the building and would like one, if you could just raise a hand, Nathan will grab one for you. There's a little pile of them there. Just a couple of us. If you're online and don't have one, I think on the Grace Church, on the main church website, you can get a link to one, or maybe Paolo will post it in the chat as well for you. So that'll be a help in a moment. But before we look at that, I want to ask you a question about Bildad. So we've just heard the reading that there's various people in the book of Job who have a speaking part if it were made into a film. Last week we had three characters: God, who rules the universe, Satan, who is his adversary, and this guy Job, who's having a really difficult time. And then in this next part of the book, we have we meet three of Job's friends: Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And I want to ask you a question about Bildad. And we heard Bildad's speech just a moment ago from Claire. Here's the question. Well, there's two questions. The first question is, does anyone know why Bildad has a claim to being the smallest man in the Bible? This is one of those Bible jokes that you either know or you don't. Does anyone know? Because he's only shoe height. I just couldn't resist that. You can only do that, you know, once in a 10 years in a church, can't you, that you talk about Bildad. But yeah, Bildad is Bildad the shoe height. That isn't a serious question. But the more serious question about Bildad is, do you think he has got it right or wrong? So I'm going to summarize what Bildad says, and then I won't get you to vote on it, because it's not fair to the people who are here, because people at home on Zoom can sort of vote privately or secretly. But I want you to vote in your mind, okay, whether he's right or not. Bildad says, if you live a good life, things will go well for you. If you live a bad life, things will go badly for you. Job, things are going badly for you, so it's your fault. Is Bildad right or wrong? Just think in your mind. Is it right that things go well for good people and things go badly for bad people? That is his thesis. And it's actually, and I asked that question at the beginning of the sermon, because it's actually a very difficult question, and it's going to take us the whole of our time this morning to try and answer this. Is it true that things go well for good people and badly for bad people? You can see Bildad's sort of thesis or his opinion in short if you turn to chapter 8. Maybe you can flick to Job chapter 8. We're going to be looking across a big section of Job today and just landing in different places. But chapter 8, we get Bildad sort of setting out his belief system. He says to Job, he answers Job, "How long will you say these things and the words of your mouth be a great wind?" Now, this is not very polite. It reminds me of Winston Churchill, who was apparently very quick-witted and had the best sort of immediate replies or put-downs to people. And he was once talking to the English playwright George Bernard Shaw. And George Bernard Shaw came up to Churchill, who was, you know, quite overweight, you know, quite a paunch, and he poked it and said, "What are you going to call it?" You know, as if to imply that Churchill was pregnant because he had such a big, you know, big belly. And quick as a flash, Churchill replied, "If it's a boy, Frederick. If it's a girl, Susan. And if it's only wind, George Bernard Shaw." It's a great comeback, isn't it? But it's quite rude to say all that comes out of you is only wind. And that is what Bildad says to Job. Now, it's quite cruel, actually, because Job, we discovered last week, is a man who is suffering appallingly. He's lost all of his livelihood. He's lost his business. But even more tragically, he's lost his kids. They all died tragically in an accident. And he's lost his health. And he's covered with these horrible festering sores and scraping himself with pottery. So here's a man who's really suffering. And Job keeps kind of wrestling with this thing. "I don't understand why this has happened to me, because I'm innocent. I don't get it. I haven't done anything wrong. Why am I suffering in this way?" And Bildad says, "Shush, Job. We've had enough of your wind." It's kind of harsh, isn't it? So here's a suffering person. He's crying out, saying, "I don't know why I'm suffering." And Bildad says, "Be quiet, because," verse 3, chapter 8, verse 3, "does God pervert justice? Does the Almighty pervert the right? No. If your children have sinned against him, he's delivered them into the hand of their transgression. If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you're pure and upright, surely then he'll rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation." See, for Bildad, things are very black and white. They're very simple. He says, look, God is just. God has not messed up the way he's running the universe. So, if your children have died, it must be they got something wrong. Verse 4. If you turn to God, verse 5, then things are going to go okay for you. It's a very black and white thing. The person who's suffering must have got it wrong. The person who's blessed must have got it right. And Job, you're suffering, your children are suffering, they must have got it wrong. If you turn to God, you get it right, then everything's going to be okay. It's a very simple view of the world. And the question is it right? Now, as Christians, I think we're pretty nervous about it, and rightly so. We're nervous of saying that the person who's suffering is the person that God's got it in for. Because, you know, we can think of lots of examples in the Bible where people suffer when they're innocent. I mean, the primary example of that would be the Lord Jesus himself, who suffered more than anybody, and yet was perfectly and utterly righteous. So a Christian should hesitate before they see someone in a wheelchair and say, "Ah, God's got it in for you." I mean, that's just sort of sounds offensive, doesn't it, to our ears? We ought to hesitate about that. That, well, the person who's got cancer, "Oh, I wonder what you did wrong." The Christian instinctively is nervous about that. And indeed, we discover at the end of the book of Job that God does not agree with Bildad. God says to Job, "You've got it right, and your friends, they talked tosh. They talked just wind." Right? Now, I had a friend who was reading Job in her quiet time some years ago. So she was spending time each day on her own to read the Bible and just working through the whole of the Bible, which is a great thing to do, you know, trying to cover the whole of the Old Testament over a couple of years. And she got the book of Job, and her practice was get up in the morning, say a prayer saying, "Lord, please help me understand your word," read a chapter or so, and then try to derive some lessons for her day. So, you know, "Lord, please help me understand." And then it's chapter 8 and it's Bildad. And so she read Bildad and she said, "Okay, help me to get some lessons from Bildad for my day," and carried on. And then it was Zophar, and then it was Eliphaz. And she, you know, this went on. Job's quite a long book, right? So it took her several weeks in her quiet times. And then she got to the end, and God says, "They got it wrong." She thought, "Well, for weeks I've been trying to take the advice of these three friends, and it turns out they've got it wrong." But actually, they haven't got it entirely wrong. And that's why this sermon is going to be, we have to concentrate quite hard. Because Bildad's view of the world, it's partly right. It's partly wrong. And we're going to have to steer a very careful course if we're going to understand suffering rightly, if we're going to know what to say to a friend who's suffering, if we're going to know how to process it ourselves when we're suffering. But actually, Job's friends, they are partly right. They're right that if you live a good life, things tend to go better for you than if you live a bad life. Just think for a minute, if they were totally wrong, like if there was no connection at all between the way you lived and the way your life turned out. Let's imagine it was just random how the universe was. Well, that would be a pretty frightening place to be. I mean, you could be a murderer. If you didn't like someone, you just kill them. And then you wouldn't face any justice. You wouldn't go to prison. You could swindle people all the time, but your business could go really well. Like, it could work. You could just grab everyone else's money and you get away with it. You could live a sort of super unhealthy lifestyle and there'd be no correlation between how little exercise you do, how many steaks you eat, and how long your life expectancy was. Yeah, imagine a world where there was just no connection at all between your behavior and the outcome of blessing in your life. It would be random. Now, of course, some people do think the world is random. Some atheists, they think, well, you know, we're here by chance and our life is governed by chance. Richard Dawkins is everyone's sort of favorite household name atheist. I was saying something the other day, Richard Dawkins, and they said, who's that? Which really comforted me. I think nowadays he's not as famous as he once was. But he's a sort of, you know, he was sort of yesterday's news. But Richard Dawkins was a sort of famous atheist speaker and often on the news and writing books and so on. And he describes the world as a world of random chance where there is at bottom no good and no evil, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. And I suppose that kind of makes sense. If you believe what he believes about the world, there is no ultimate ruler, there's no moral God who runs it, it's just here by accident. Well, then if an accidental random world, I mean, why should it reward good and why should it punish bad? And so therefore, why shouldn't you just live as you want? Live any way you choose. Live in the way best calculated to propagate your own DNA and to hell with everybody else, quite literally. I mean, why not? But actually, the universe isn't like that. And it's actually really important for us to know that the builder and his friends are partly right. They're right in the sense that God runs the universe morally. And bad things happen to bad people. It's kind of obvious, isn't it? If you lie to everybody and once everyone finds out, then they won't trust you anymore. And if your business swindles everybody, then after a while no one does business with you anymore. And if you sleep around, then you're more likely to get a sexually transmitted disease. And if you do no exercise and eat only steaks, you're likely to die early from heart disease. And you know, there is a kind of cause and effect built into the world. But there's a moral cause and effect built into the world because God is a moral God and he governs the universe morally. So let's hear from Eliphaz in chapter 4. I'll read it to you. He says, remember, who was innocent ever perished? When were the upright cut off? As I've seen, those who plough iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the breath of God they perish. By the blast of his anger they're consumed. I mean, that's our kids' talk, isn't it? That I love James's letter C. I love the way that the children are like, obviously, that would not go that. It's brilliant, isn't it? It's so clear, isn't it, even to our youngsters in church, that you reap what you sow. And the New Testament tells us that, and we saw it in the book of Galatians. But actually, that's what Eliphaz says. If you plough iniquity, if you plough into the ground evil, then you're going to reap the same. Because God set up the universe that way. I mean, it's right. If God hadn't set up the universe that way, then God would not be a moral God. You know, if you went around all the time and the people who lived the most evil lives did the best, you kind of end up thinking, is God still sort of running the universe correctly? Has he fallen asleep at the controls? Surely it ought to be that it goes well for the good and it goes badly for the evil. I mean, it's right, isn't it? And then we looked at Bildad. Let's go back to Bildad in chapter 8. And Bildad asked the question, does God pervert justice? Verse 3. No, of course he doesn't. God is not an unjust God. And if he's not an unjust God, that means that God's got to reward good and punish evil. That's what it means to be a moral being. And then see if you can find the echoes of this. Listen to verse 11, chapter 8, verse 11. Can papyrus grow where there's no marsh? Can reeds flourish where there's no water? While yet in flower and not cut down, they wither before any other plant. Such are the paths of all who forget God. The hope of the godless shall perish. And then verse 16, he's like a lush plant before the sun, its shoots spread over the garden, his roots entwine the stone heap, he looks upon a house of stones. If he's destroyed from his place, it will deny him, saying, I've never seen you. Behold, this is the joy of his way. Out of the soil, others will spring. This is another sort of horticultural metaphor. This time, it's not you reap what you sow. This time, it's if you plant near a good water supply, then lush vegetation. And if you plant a long way from water, then it's all going to wither up. It's another metaphor for the same thing. And this one, well, it's the same as Psalm 1, which we said together. You know, blessed is the man who doesn't walk in the counsel of the wicked, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. He's like a tree planted by streams of water, and all that he does prospers. Not so the wicked. The wicked is like chaff that is blown away, like the dry stuff. Is that metaphor? Now, what I'm trying to show us here is that what Job's friend says is right, and it's what the rest of the Bible says. So Eliphaz, he says the same as Paul in Galatians. You reap what you sow. And Bildad, he says the same as David in Psalm 1. It goes well for you if you follow God's ways. In fact, in Job chapter 5, it's Eliphaz speaking again. His words are actually quoted by Paul in 1 Corinthians to say, you know, Eliphaz got it right. This is what he says. Now, the reason I say this is because if you know a little bit about Job, then you know that at the end God says they're all wrong, and then you ditch what they say. And I'm just saying it's a little bit more complicated than that. They have got it wrong, in a way we'll find out in a minute, but they've kind of got it basically right. They are basically right that if you live a good life, it goes well for you. And if you live a bad life, it goes badly for you. And the rest of the Bible, it says the same. Psalm 1 says the same. Galatians says the same. 1 Corinthians says the same. And then it happens the same. So in Acts chapter 12, again in the New Testament, it works out the same. Let me read it to you. Acts chapter 12, verse 23. King Herod, an evil king, he persecuted God's people. And he starts to be worshipped because he quite likes the idea of being almost like a divinity. And what happens to him, verse 23, immediately an angel of the Lord struck him down because he didn't give glory to God. He was eaten by worms and breathed his last. Yeah, that's kind of justice, right? Yeah, you start accepting God's worship, you don't give honor to God, you die and worms eat you. You reap what you sow. If you walk God's way, it goes well for you. If you turn your back on God, it goes badly for you. Don't be fooled. A man reaps what he sows. That is true. And it's really important that it's true. Otherwise, what motive do we have for living the right way? If it's irrelevant, if it's random, well, then just be selfish. Just be grabbing. Just get whatever you can. Just lie as long as people don't notice you're lying. Just cheat as long as people don't spot that you're cheating. What's the point in doing otherwise? But this is a moral universe. It's not a random universe. It's a universe governed by God who knows the difference between good and evil. And he rewards good and he punishes evil. It's the basic fabric of the universe. And Bildad and Eliphaz and Zophar, Job's friends, they know that. But how come at the end of the book then God says they got it wrong? Well, this is the problem. They're right that bad things happen to bad people and good things happen to good people. But they're wrong to think that it always works like that. In general, that is the trend. You know, it tends to be that way. Generally, if you go around beating people up, you find yourself in prison for GBH, generally. Not always. Now, some people can be real bullies and somehow they get away with it. Generally, if you eat really badly and do no exercise, then you don't live very long, but not always. You know, some very unhealthy people live a long time, right? It's not always like that. Sometimes, if you suffer, it's because you've turned your back on God, but not always. Sometimes there are people whose lives are a mess even though they've walked with Jesus, they've turned away from evil, they've sought his forgiveness, they're reconciled to God, they're forgiven from all their wrongs, and yet their life is still horrible. And so what Bildad and Eliphaz and Zophar have got wrong is they've got a correct principle, and then they've assumed it works in every single case. They've universalized it. And so they say to Job, well, Job, you're suffering, and so you must have done something wrong. They assume that the sufferer is always guilty. Now, often, the sufferer is guilty. Often we get what we deserve, but not always. And that's the point. Job, in the book of Job, he knows that he's innocent. And I said this last week, I'll say it again. Innocent in the Bible, it doesn't mean he's never done anything wrong, because that isn't true of anyone. Like, all of us are sinners, and Job's a sinner. But Job's a sinner who turns away from his sin. And there was that wonderful description of him that we saw last week in chapter 1. Job was a blameless and upright man who feared God and turned away from evil. So he's not saying, I'm sinless. He is saying, I'm repentant. There isn't any evil in my life that I haven't turned away from. When I said confession in church, I guess at Job's church, I mean, it's back before Jesus, they wouldn't have said the words quite the same as us. But he would have said something similar to God. God, I know my faults and I'm sorry for them, and I trust in your mercy, and please forgive me. In fact, we discovered last week that Job was often performing sacrifices just in case one of his family had sinned. And that was an Old Testament way of saying, Lord, I trust in your forgiveness, and that by sacrifice you will cleanse me and my family from our sin. It's like the Old Testament equivalent of putting your trust in Jesus, the ultimate sacrifice. And Job did that. So he's not sinless, but he is repentant. And he says, I don't understand what's happening to me, because there's nothing in my life that I haven't turned over to God. I've sought his forgiveness. I've turned away from evil. I don't get it. And so you've got Job's sort of clear conscience comes at loggerheads with Bildad's black and white view of the world. No, Job, you can't be innocent. There must be something, because, you know, God's not unjust, is he? There must be something you've done wrong that causes God to punish you in this way. And Job goes, I don't think there is. I don't understand it, because my conscience is clear. No, Job, you're not being honest now. There's something that's wrong. Job thinks he's innocent, but of course we got an advantage as the readers, because we know that God also thinks that Job is innocent, because we read chapter 1 and 2. And poor Job didn't get to read chapters 1 and 2, because chapter 1 and 2 was a rare glimpse into what's actually going on in heaven in a conversation that God has with the angels. And we don't often get to find out what's going on in heaven and what God's saying. But in this case, we do. And God said twice, we saw last week, he said, Job's innocent. Have you seen anyone like Job? Job is a man who is blameless and upright. He fears God and he turns away from evil. So we know that that's what God thinks. And so we know that Job's suffering is not punishment. And again, there's examples in the New Testament of the same thing. So in Luke chapter 13, there's a natural disaster where, or maybe it's poor building work, where a tower collapses and 18 people die in a place called Siloam. And Jesus says, do you think that the people living there were worse sinners than everybody else because they suffered in this way? And if Bildad had been there, he'd have gone, yes. You know, towers only fall on wicked people, and righteous people walk past towers and they stay up, because that's just how a moral universe would work. But Jesus says, no, you're wrong. In this case, those people were not worse sinners, even though they suffered in this way. And there's another example of some people who are brutally persecuted for their faith. Some people in Galilee who the Roman governor massacred, or Roman soldiers massacred. And Jesus says, do you think they were worse sinners because they suffered in this way? No. Do you think the people in Afghanistan who died in the bomb, that God had it in for them because he let them be blown up by Islamic State K? No. Do you think the people who died in the tsunami in Indonesia years and years ago, do you think they were specially guilty because they had a tsunami? Whereas all the people in beaches in Miami were innocent? No. See, Jesus, it doesn't always work out like this. The people who suffer are not always the people who are guilty or especially guilty. There's another example in John chapter 9 where there's a man who's born blind. And Jesus' disciples asked him, Jesus, who sinned? Was it this guy or his parents that caused him to be born blind? You see their mentality, it's just the Bildad mentality. If someone's disabled, it must be, you know, their fault somehow or their parents' fault. And Jesus goes, no, you're wrong. Actually, it wasn't that they sinned, it was because God had destined them for God's glory. Actually, just wait and see what happens to this blind man and his life's going to be changed and he's going to be a great testimony to God. So here's the point. Sometimes, often, bad things happen to bad people and good things happen to good people. If that wasn't true, the universe would be random, there'd be no moral government, there'd be no point in living the right way. Often, good happens to the good and bad happens to the bad. You reap what you sow. But not always. Not always. And that is the key thing. In other words, because it's not always the case, and so we've got to be super, super careful when it comes to playing the blame game. I can't tell why your suffering happened. You can't tell why my suffering happened. You can't look at a suffering person and say, you got what's coming to you. Now, I think, instinctively, I think we know that. If I were to point somebody in a wheelchair or point somebody in a cancer ward and say, you're getting what you deserve, I think everyone would be enormously shocked by that, I think. In fact, years and years ago, the England football manager, a guy called Glenn Hoddle, he said something very similar to that. And there was an absolute uproar. It was in all the national papers. And I don't even care about football, and I know he said that. So, you know, everyone was talking about it. How could you possibly say that people are suffering because they're bad? But the thing is that Glenn Hoddle was only saying what millions of people in the world believe. Because, I mean, that is the view of karma. It is the view of the Eastern religions, like Hinduism and Buddhism and so on. That just is the view. You know, you live your life over and over again in a cycle of reincarnation. If you live a good life last time round, you come back and it goes better for you in this life. And if you lived a bad life last time round, you go around and it comes out worse for you in this life. And, you know, it's a sort of karma. It's like you reap what you sow, absolutized. Like it always works like that. Actually, a friend of mine who is a GP in East London, but who grew up in India, in a country with enormous suffering and sort of disparities between rich and poor, she says in her own country, she's actually a Christian, but she said in her own country, the sort of principle of karma, which many people believe, it helps people to kind of put up with suffering that they see, because they kind of go, well, it's kind of what you deserved. And I know we're shocked by that, but a lot of people in the world believe that. But Christians don't believe in karma. It's true that it goes well for the good and it goes bad for the bad, but not always. And that's also the reason that we've got to be very careful about a kind of Christianized version of karma, which is known as the prosperity gospel or the health and wealth gospel. And this is a kind of, it's not Christian, but it sort of pretends to be Christian. And it's taught in churches that pretend to be Christian churches by people who pretend to be Christian preachers. And they say something like this. You want to live your best life, the best version of your life? Well, as long as you give some money to charity and particularly to our organization, then God will bless you. If you want a new car, if you want success in your career, if you want your family to prosper and your children to turn out well, then if only you devote yourself to God and give some money to this credit card number, then God will bless you. And it's kind of a version of Bildad. You know, it'll go well for the good and it'll go badly for the bad. It's sort of absolutized and corrupted and combined with a lot of greed. And frighteningly, some of these Christian teachers, they have private jets. I mean, like, they actually do have private jets. And you can, you know, you can look up online. and it's frightening that this kind of thing is taught in the name of Christianity. And people go for it. In fact, particularly sufferers go for it. People who are having a hard time go for it. So in very poor parts of the world, people buy into this. I'm suffering and I want the key. And they say, well, the key is, if you just live the right kind of Christian life, then everything will go well. Oh, great, I want everything to go well. So I'll give all my money to these sort of corrupt teachers in the hope that that will unlock God's blessing for me. It's a deeply, deeply twisted and dangerously wrong thing. It's a twisting of the Bible because it absolutizes, it makes always true something that's only sometimes true. So let me say these two things again. Bildad is right and he's wrong. He's right that bad things happen to bad people. If you want to live a life that is long and happy, and then walk with God. And that's what Psalm 1 says. It's true. You reap what you sow. Sow to the Spirit, and from the Spirit you'll reap eternal life. Don't sow to the flesh, and from the flesh you'll reap destruction. I mean, that is really true. But it's not always true. As in, there's people who love Jesus, who turn from evil, who seek his forgiveness, and they suffer. And they're in wheelchairs, or they're in cancer wards, or they've lost their job, or they're destitute, or they're stuck in Afghanistan, they can't get out, or whatever it might be. There's people like Job. He's having a terrible time, and everyone assumes that he must have done something wrong, but actually, he's God's poster boy for a guy who's got it absolutely right. It is possible as a Christian, in fact, it's common as a Christian, to suffer for doing good. So how do we hold these two things together? Does it go well for good people or not? And I'm saying sometimes. Sometimes it does. And you ought to be thinking, imagine yourself as Bildad. You ought to kind of not be satisfied with that answer. If it only sometimes goes well for good people, and it only sometimes goes bad for bad people, then well, it goes back to our initial question. Is the universe being morally governed? Has God got it right? Does God sometimes not notice? You know, why doesn't it work out consistently like this? And that brings us to our third point. It does always work out like that in the end. In the end, it always goes well for those people who turn to God, turn away from evil, seek his forgiveness. Always goes well in the end for them. And it always goes badly in the end for those who reject God and turn their back on him. Not always in this life, actually, but always on the final judgment day. Always in the future. Always when God separates people into those who will go to the new creation with him and those who will be banished in hell. He'll get it absolutely right, absolutely every time. And there'll be no kind of exceptions like Job on that day. And ironically, Bildad, he's got that right. So what I'm trying to say is these chapters of Job, you've got to read them carefully. They're not to be binned as wrong. They're just to be treated very carefully and not universalized. But Bildad, he knows. And in fact, Bildad gives us, chapter 18, probably one of the best Old Testament sermons on hell. There's lots of sermons on hell in the Bible. Most of them are by Jesus, actually. So it's not a kind of scary God of the Old Testament, friendly God of the New Testament thing. Jesus is the frightening, most scary one of all. Jesus is the one who most often talks about hell. But Bildad talks about hell. Chapter 18, verse 5. The light of the wicked is put out. And it will be, in the end, in hell. Or verse 8, he's cast into a net by his own feet. He walks on its mesh. A trap seizes him by the heel. A snare lays hold of him. A rope is hidden for him in the ground. A trap for him in the path. Terrors frighten him at every side and chase him at his heels. In other words, in the end, evil catches up with you. It's like, you know, you're walking, like an animal walking over a netting, and they don't even see the netting's there. And they don't even see the hidden rope and the trigger mechanism, all ready to suddenly scoop you up like in a trap. And you're walking right in the middle of it, and there you are, and the net's all around you, and you don't know. And in the end, Bildad says, it will get you. And he's right, it will, in hell. See, Bildad's got it right. He's just got the timescale wrong. It's not always the case here and now that the wicked get trapped in the net. There are some very wicked people in this world who are getting away with it, it seems. And there are some very godly people, some forgiven, repentant people, for whom things are going very badly right now. But in the end, the net catches the wicked. And in the end, the righteous sufferers are vindicated. And we're going to zoom right to the very end of Job, just to see how it all turns out. Because I didn't think you could wait another 4 weeks for the punchline. And I'm only going to read from chapter 42 and verse 7. After the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my anger burns against you and against your two friends, and Bildad and Zophar, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. You know, Job was right, he really was innocent, and you were wrong, it wasn't his fault. Now therefore, take seven bulls and seven rams and go to my servant Job and offer up a burnt offering for yourself. And my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept his prayer not to deal with you according to your folly. For you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. So Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Nathamite went and did what the Lord had told them. And the Lord accepted Job's prayer. I think this is a beautiful resolution, actually. What is the best possible outcome for Job? Well, part one, he's vindicated before his accusers. I mean, the hardest thing for Job about his suffering is what? I mean, he loses his wealth. I mean, you can do without money. He loses his family. I mean, that's terribly tragic. He loses his health. His own life is on the line. That's terribly tragic. But then he almost loses his spiritual footing. And that's the most tragic thing of all. He questions himself, actually, am I God's friend? Has God got it in for me? And his friends are saying, no, you've done something wrong. You're a sinner. God is against you. That's almost the cruelest torture of all. I can remember a friend when I was at university. And she had cancer. She's called Emma. And she's only 19, I think, and she had bone cancer. And she was dying. And some people at her parents' church told her, if you turn to God and trust him, you'll get better. And can I say, I think that was the cruelest thing that anyone had said to her. It was crueler than what the oncologists had said when they said, you got cancer and you're not going to make it. Because added to the suffering of her chemo and the cancer itself, was this spiritual anguish of, am I not right with God? Is God against me? Have I got something that I haven't sorted out in my life? And unfortunately, she had her head screwed on, and she knew that they were wrong, and it was nonsense. And she said, I trust Jesus, and I know at the end, on the judgment day, whether or not I die of cancer, I'm going to be with him in the new creation forever. And she is rock solid. But, I mean, the hardest thing for Job, I mean, I don't know which of them is harder. Losing your family, awful. Losing your health, awful. But what his friends are saying, this sort of torment of their advice, really awful. And at the end, they're the ones who have to come to him and say sorry. And Job has to pray for them, for God to forgive them. I love that, because it's sort of putting the resolution in such a way as Job is vindicated before them. And they say, no, Job, you were God's friend. And we're sorry for everything we said. I don't know whether there'll be something similar on the judgment day for the prosperity gospel preachers. Whether they'll have to come and face up to some of the Christians who suffered the most in the world. Christians in Syria. Christians with cancer. And say, we got it really wrong. And it turns out you were really close to God whilst we were speaking lies. It's a wonderful moment of vindication in the end. And then verse 10, the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he prayed for his friends. The Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then came to him all his brothers and sisters and all who'd known him before and ate bread with him in his house. They showed him sympathy and comforted him for all the harm or evil that the Lord had brought upon him. Each of them gave him a piece of money and a ring of gold. And the Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning. He had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, 1,000 female donkeys. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and so on. And verse 16, after this, Job lived for 140 years. He saw his son's sons, 4 generations. Job dies an old man, full of days. And at the end you go, well, it turned out well for Job. Why? Well, because he loved God. He turned from evil. He sought God's forgiveness. It always goes well in the end for those who walk with God. It always goes badly in the end for those who turn their back on God. But it doesn't always work out like that in the here and now. So I've put 2 coffee questions on the bottom of this part of the handout. And it says this, when something goes wrong, are you too quick to jump to the conclusion that God's upset with you? Are you too slow to reach the conclusion that God might be upset with you? In other words, Bildad, he's half right. This is a moral universe. If our life is going badly, it's worth asking the question, am I living badly? Have I sought God's forgiveness for my faults? Am I turning away from evil and back to him and to his way? Because it goes better, generally, when you walk God's way. It's worth asking that question. But it doesn't always work like that in the here and now. Sometimes God's friends get cancer, or get killed in wars, or lose their job, or have children who go off the rails, or all sorts of suffering. Sometimes. And so we need to put our hope in the final day. That's the day when everything gets sorted out. When it goes well for God's friends and it goes badly for God's enemies. A pause and then we're going to be led in prayer.